Chapter 26. They told me that the trip will be arduous and long. How long? 5-6 days. A side trail. But before starting, I decided to see one of the outlets to Havasu Canyon that used to be a part of the old trail, and that was used as an inlet when General Crook and his soldiers came there. The trail is called after a spring bearing the name Pacathatruyiba. Never did I have such a sense of the maze of canyons contained in this system of canyons as on that trip. My guide was Sunila, one of the most intelligent Indians of the whole tribe. We left the Havasupai village early one morning, each riding an Indian pony, with all the provisions we thought we should need on our saddles. After a while, we entered a side canyon I had never before explored. During the whole of that day we toiled, riding as hard as we could over the almost trackless canyon floor, trailing through deep sand, climbing over masses of boulders that freshets or cloud dashbursts had piled between the walls, forcing our way through dense willows, scratched by thickets of mesquites. Again and again in the walls were seen cliff dwellings and corn storage houses. The heat was intense, and radiated from the precipitous walls on either side. The camp at night. When night came, we ate our frugal meal, our horses standing by waiting to be hobbled and turned loose. For beds, we had the nearest layer of sand we could find, with our saddles for pillows. Suffering from thirst. Early in the morning we started again, winding and curving with the course of the canyon. For nearly 2 days we had been without fresh water, and the little we had brought in our wicker-woven, pinyon gum-covered asuas had to suffice for our needs. Suddenly we entered a vast amphitheater, with a rude arch at the end. It was flower-covered, with occasional trees, and here, hidden from any but the view of an Indian, was found a tiny spring of coolest, purest water. How we enjoyed it! A dangerous slope. On the third day, we came to the place where the soldiers descended from the plateau above into the depths of the canyon. There was no well-defined trail, and the slope was steep enough to make one's flesh creep. The site was marked with disaster. Here a pack mule had slipped, fallen, and been dashed to pieces. There a man had fallen and been killed. It was a difficult descent, but nerve and pluck had accomplished it. Beyond was the Pacathatruyiba spring, and after seeing its water I determined that we must return, capturing wild ponies. On our way back, Sunila made a proposition that, as our ponies were exceedingly weary, we catch some fresh ones of his, for this was his talk range, and he knew where there were plenty of good animals. The horses were wild, as range horses generally are, but Sunila was crafty. He knew of a blind ravine, or rocky pocket, into which we could drive the horses we needed, and to that end all our energies were directed. Darting back and forth, to arrest the dodging and fleeing animals, we at length succeeded in ending about a dozen horses in the pocket. Then I watched Sunila, hand extended, slowly and stealthily approach the pony he needed. Time and again, as he got nearer and nearer, all the time making a peculiar sissing sound, the horse would suddenly swing around and endeavor to dash away. But I was lured of the gate, and it was my business to see that none of the band escaped. It took us fully 2 hours to catch the two horses. At last they were ours. Neither was well broken, though both had been ridden, and the first thing Sunila did was to blindfold them. The saddles were removed from our jaded ponies and placed upon the new ones. The starts of terror and anger showed what we had ahead of us. Bridles were adjusted, and then, with our fresh ponies still blindfolded, we sprang into our saddles. When our feet were firmly placed, and all was ready, we lifted the blinds from the horse's eyes, and then braced ourselves. Digging our heels into the pony's sides, off we started, at a jerking, bounding, half-bucking pace. Shouting directions to each other, helter-skelter, over and around boulders, we dashed along, as if we were after the hounds on a genuine old-fashioned fox hunt. I suppose we kept it up a full hour, at topmost speed. The horses didn't want to stop, and Sunila knew that the best way to break them was to let them have their own way. But before the day was over, the ponies were considerably tamed down, and it was a weary band that stopped for camp that night. The animals were duly hobbled and turned loose. I lit a campfire, though we had nothing to cook, and no kettle for boiling water, and dirty, moldy, with every nerve and fiber of my body weary and aching, I finally stretched out on the solid earth and wooed on me sleep. The ride was resumed next day. We finally got ourselves to Sunila's camp in safety, where a sweat bath and a swim in the delicious waters of Havasu fully rested us. The Hopi Trail ascent. We decided to leave Havasu Canyon by way of the Make Trail. This is the same trail as that described in the chapter on the descent into Havasu Canyon from El Tovar, as far up as the point where the pictured rocks appear. Here the Hopi Trail turns and follows the course of the main Havasu Canyon. Cushing counted 44 knots in his buckskin fringe from the village to the exit, each knot denoting an abrupt curve or angle in the winding canyons. The Topocabia Trail descends a sheer cliff of stupendous majesty, and the Hualapai Trail is enough to shatter the nervous system of any but the most experienced. But the Hopi Trail ascent out of the canyon is different, in that, in several places, it passes through narrow clefts, with ponderous, overhanging rocks, the whole course barely wide enough to permit a laden mule to get through with its pack. It is an almost vertical ascent of about 1,200 feet which winds around and up the clefts, up steps hacked out of the solid rock with flint axes and hammers, by the patient hands of long-dead Indians. The legend of Ahuja. The Hopis and the Zunis believe this to be the spot where the Zuni god, Ahuja, one of the twin gods of war, after the waters of the world, had arisen and overwhelmed the nations of their ancestry, and flooded the whole earth from the far west to the Rio Grande, dug a little outlet for the waters. The flood, finding this hole, had rushed down into the interior of the earth, and had thus worn this terrific cleft, and the gorge below, leaving the marks of its strife upon the banded rocks which surrounded and hovered over us. Now we scrambled over great rocks, then along a foot-wide trail, and at length wound our way out along a massive bank of talus. Around at the head of the trail, I sent Sunila back, and started alone along the historic trail across the plateau. The general scenery of the plateau already has been described. A roundabout drive. At this point, I prevailed upon Mr. Bass to hitch two horses and two mules to his ambulance, which had once been a United States Army ambulance, and was used in his Arizona campaigns by General Nelson A. Miles, and drive a roundabout way to the northeastern slopes of the San Francisco Range, thence to the Little Colorado River, where we would again strike the Hopi Trail from Minkabai to Araby. There were four of us in the party. From the rim of the canyon direct to the Little Colorado the route is, at present, inaccessible for wagons. It is a horse trail, and somewhat of the same nature as all the plateau trails through the Coconino forest. Hence our roundabout wagon trip. On the fringe of the Painted Desert, filling our canteens to the nozzle, we drove over the western fringe of the Painted Desert. Skirting the mountain, we made a dry camp that night, and used up every drop of water next morning. Some went for our coffee, and the rest was given to the animals. Then we started for the faraway Tanner crossing of the Little Colorado, across the thirsty desert. As we were without water, it was natural that, on that particular day, the elements should combine to make it hotter than usual. A few clouds sprang into existence, but we felt no breath of cooling air, and as the day grew, the clouds became burning glasses to focus the sun's heat more powerfully upon us. Late in the afternoon, our eyes were delighted with the sight of what seemed to be a pool of water in the road ahead of us. parched almost to keen suffering, we drove our weary and thirsty horses right into it, scaring away, as we did so, several horses that were standing there, and then, not waiting for cups or ceremony, each man threw himself flat on his stomach and began to drink the uninviting compound. A heavy shower had fallen in this one spot, and the pool had not yet had time to evaporate. A dash across the Little Colorado. The day was sultry, and Bedekind a heavy rainstorm, so, when we reached the Little Colorado, we decided to get over that night, since, if the storm came, it might render crossing impossible. Our ambulance was heavily laden, and the crossing dangerous. Before I ventured, we unloaded about half the weight, and then I undressed, save for my undershirt, and went to investigate the bed of the crossing for quicksands. As soon as I had determined where to drive, we started across. Whipping up the mules, and keeping their necks well into their collars, we dashed across in safety. Immediately the wagon was unloaded, I turned it around and crossed alone. The remainder of the load was put in, with our two men, and, one of them seated by my side with the whip, we yelled ourselves across again. Our wagon was stopped in a sandy drift, our grub box thrown out, a fire lighted, and with the impending storm in close proximity, we hurriedly cooked and ate our evening meal. No sooner was my plate cleared than, taking my roll of blankets, I wearily threw them down not more than 10 feet from the wagon, too utterly laid out to seek shelter in the cliff beyond, where a number of cave-like shelves afforded good level sleeping places, secure from the storm. As I unrolled my blankets, I called to the men, to be sure to put out the campfire and place the sugar sack, etc., in the grub box and close the lid. I was no sooner stretched out than I was sound asleep. A storm at night. One of my companions insisted upon unrolling his blankets close to me, in spite of the fact that a terrible storm might break over us at any time. Poor fellow! He had scarcely gotten to sleep when a frightful gust of wind swept down upon us. Awakened with the noise, my eye caught a glimpse of the flaming brands from the fire, being tossed into the wagon, and I rushed to the rescue. In a fierce wind, with a wagon and its contents dried out by the fierce Arizona sun, I knew there was not a moment to lose. Fortunately, I had left a pail of water close by, and with this, I doused out not only the flames in the wagon, but the remnant of the campfire. It was pitch dark by now. All at once, with a light that was blinding in its intensity, and with a terrible clap of thunder, the storm burst upon us. It was, without any question, one of the fiercest short storms, accompanied with the most vivid lightning, I have ever seen. The darkness was so black that, like that of Egypt during the plague, it seemed almost as if it might be felt. With a suddenness that was awe-inspiring, it became light as noonday. The lightning was of a brilliant violet tint, and shone with fervent intensity. And it was not merely a few flashes. It came down in millions of jagged streaks, completely filling the heavens to the horizon in every direction. A frightened traveler. In one of these blinding flashes, I caught sight of my neighbor. His face wore an expression of anguish. In his dread he had arisen, and had tried to pick up his clothes and blankets, in the hope of reaching shelter. In one of the sudden lulls of the tempest, I heard him talking to himself, "Colon, shall I ever live through this awful night? Can I get to those cliffs? Why doesn't someone come to help me? I'm going to die. There's no help for it." Taking advantage of the next flash, I picked up my blankets and carried them to the cliffs, then returned to him, gathered up his belongings, and urged him to follow me. As soon as he was secure, I spread out my sopping wet blankets in the first space I could find. Wet through as I was, I rolled myself up in my wetter blankets, and soon should have been asleep, had it not been for the moanings of the man I had rescued. He wished he hadn't come. He was sure the exposure would kill him, and he wondered why people were such fools as to take unnecessary trips. Just then the storm waters from above, seeking their accustomed drainage channels, found their way down to a rock which overhung my sleeping place as a root spout, and began to pour upon me in bucketfuls. Yet I vowed I would never admit that my sleep was in the slightest disturbed. So I turned over in my watery bed, and kept up the play until morning came, while the angry man complained the entire time. Funny? In spite of my own misery, it was funny enough to make a burro laugh. 2 days rest. It took us a couple of days to get well dried out, which we spent at Tuba City, a Mormon town since abandoned by order of the courts, which found that it was illegally located on an Indian reserve. Then we enjoyed a day or two at Mancopi, watching the Hopi Indians at their interesting occupations, caring for their fields, and preparing to go on to Araby, 40 miles distant, where the snake dance was soon to occur. Camp at Blue Canyon. The heat was fearful. It was the middle of August and the sand made hard pulling for the horses. It was late in the evening before we reached Blue Canyon. The road was uncertain, so we camped on the rim above, leading our animals down, as best we could, to a Navajo hogan, where we thought we might get water and some corn stalks for them. We got both, and then decided to hobble the animals and turn them loose in the canyon while we returned to our wagon above. The wind had come up and was blowing fiercely, so, in the dark, I chose for a sleeping place a piece of ground that was somewhat sheltered from it. It was irregular, rocky and rolling, and as the wind continued to blow, the fine sand blew over and onto my face, while the coarser sand settled into my blankets. It was not a refreshing and comforting night. An exciting descent. In the morning, when we went down for our animals, we found that they had broken through the flimsy fence of the Navajo, and had worked considerable havoc in his corn patch. The Navajo grumbled and gesticulated, and showed unmistakable anger, but I took the matter coolly, and, after seeing the extent of the damage, quietly asked the head of the family colon to qui peso? How many dollars? On receiving his answer, I offered to give him sugar and flour to that amount. We became friends at once, and he invited us to bring our wagon down and spend the day with him. As we were all wearied, we decided to do so. To save going around by the wagon road, he showed us a quicker way of descent. It was a sandbank not quite vertical, but as nearly so as ever anyone drove down and lived to tell the tale. So, harnessing the animals, we brought the wagon to the edge of this sandy descent, then, tying all the wheels securely, so that they would drag, all of us holding onto the hind axle, and with weights trailing behind, the whole mass went over. Though we threw ourselves into the sand, and held onto our ropes, it was only by expert driving that the animals were kept from being crushed. Experience with a Navajo pilot. The next day we pushed on to Araby, piloted by a Navajo. When we reached the western side of the mesa, I decided to go up the foot trail directly to the village, so as to have water and corn fodder awaiting the animals when they got safely around to the eastern side. The Navajo got it into his head that the wagon was to be driven up the slope onto the mesa, an impossible thing without making a road. There was a trail for horses and burros, however, and the driver yielded to the Navajo's guidance. At last a sheer cliff was reached, up which only trail stock could possibly go. There the party was, with 4 saddle animals harnessed to a wagon, in a cul-de-sac, consisting of a spot barely large enough for the wagon to stand on, a deep precipice on the right, a steep cliff ascending on the left, and the animals ahead on the sandy slope as steep as the one we had descended at Blue Canyon, a day or two before. Fearful for the safety of animals and wagon, the only course was retreat. A crude road was built, and, after tying wheels and trailing ropes on as before, with the help of a number of Indians who had come to look on, the whole outfit was lowered to the level below in safety. An unforgettable memory. Thus we had come over a large part of the historic Hopi Trail, never designed or planned for a wagon, with our ambulance. and the memories of the trip, arduous though it was, linger in the mind, side by side with experiences of the snake dance, and other unforgettable and delightful remembrances. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.